right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and here at my left is the brains behind the operation, the lovely Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
I don't know if we can go that far with the brains, but...
Well, I'm the looks, and you're the brains, I thought.
Okay. Hello. Hello, everybody.
Good to have you here, Zilpha.
I'm always here, John.
And joining us again is our old friend Christian from the East Coast. Hey, Christian.
Hello, welcome. I'm glad to be here from the Palmetto State.
Yeah, it's been a while. Why have you been such a stranger?
Just a little bit going on.
that's true. And tonight we have a special guest I've been looking forward to talking to for some time. That like a lot of our podcasts, this one we run into schedule conflicts, but Dr. Darren Smith. Darren, welcome to Mormon Expression.
Welcome. How are you? It's wonderful to be here, everyone. Pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Well, let's have you introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us who Dr. Darren Smith is.
Well, you can drop the doctor piece and just call me Darren. That's fine. I'm currently I'm working at the university in Kansas, a little small school called Wichita State. And I'm there doing what I do, teaching, writing, and a scholarship. So I'm trying to make the world a better place and leave it a better place before I came here, if at all possible. So that's what I do, and I'm looking forward to being on this panel. I really thank everyone for inviting me.
What's your history in Mormonism, or what do you have to do with Mormonism?
I don't have much to do with it. No, just kidding. That's a great question. Well, currently, I am LDS. I've been a member of the church since 1981, I believe, is when
wow.
I joined. And so I joined in Nashville, Tennessee, back in the day, back in the South, the dirty. And, shortly thereafter, I left there and, went out west, to Utah and Idaho. And that's where I discovered that such a thing called racism actually exists, and I'll explain that later as we discuss this.
Wow. And well, you I would mention that you were on Mormon Stories back in 2006, so if anybody's interested in hearing more about your personal experiences, they could go listen to that episode.
Sure.
Now, Darren, you were on staff or faculty, I mean, at BYU at one time, weren't you?
At BYU, you say?
Yeah.
Yes, I was.
There's a little story there. How come you're no longer at the BYU?
Well, I think that the institution I guess, were tired of my public groanings and ramblings and so on about the church's history, its past, as you all know, very well know. And I think they just decided that it was probably best for me to depart the institution. They didn't simply renew my contract. So it's kind of how that ended. And I remember going into the office. It was the department where the faculty are often scrutinized. I forget the name of the department, but there's a department set up to monitor just faculty activities. So I was called into that office, and I went to speak to the gentleman who was there, who was over it, Brother So-and-so. And Brother So-and-so told me that I need to be careful regarding the ways of men, the theories of men, because the theories of men is what gets folks in trouble. We should rely more on the theories of God rather than the theories of men. I said, so how do you explain mistreatment, racial discrimination, racial animus, et cetera? And he just, I guess he didn't have anything to say at the time. He's kind of looked at me puzzled. So he responded back once he gathered himself and said, there are some things that we don't understand that God has put forward that we don't understand. Of course, you know, I fundamentally disagree with that. But anyway, that was my experience on the way out. Now, I can tell you that my experience at the institution, Brigham Young, was phenomenal. The students are incredible. They're smart. They're bright. You know, if pushed, they tend to respond like most white students do when you're talking about issues of race. But I think that in terms of the overall tenor of the school and the actual students' ability to understand the material and to be transformed by it was fabulous. In fact, I would even go on record as saying that BYU had some of the finest undergraduate students I've ever taught in the state of Utah. True, and that's the honest truth. The problem that I had at BYU was not with the students, but with the administration. The old guard who continue to police the institution, like it's a thought fortress. Mm-hmm. And so until that changes, I'm afraid BYU is going to remain stagnant, and it's going to continue to reproduce itself in ways that I don't think it, that flatters Brigham Young, his vision of what he wanted BYU to become. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it's definitely a school with an identity crisis. And I think you hit it on the head. When I was there, you know, you have a lot of very bright Mormon kids who come to the school who are full of, curiosity and even white guilt and are ready to, move forward on issues. And then you have, you know, the faculty that's, well, not even the faculty, the administration. I know when I was there, the, Turk, was Bruce Hafen. And yeah, they ruled with an iron fist. So if you don't toe the line, well, Darren, you joined a long line of, great people who have been asked to leave.
Yes. Yes. I'm very familiar with this past and what's happened over the years. And it's unfortunate because these individuals could truly help the institution become what it, I'm sure what it wants to be. But as long as folks' thought are policed and their scholarship is under surveillance, it makes it very difficult to do the kind of scholarship and the kind of research that you want to do that someone wants to do, particularly in my case where much of the research that I do centers around race and racial identity and racial politics and so on. And of course, the LDS Church has always been an area of interest of mine in terms of obviously from my individual religious persuasion and so on, but also scholarly, looking at it scholarly. And of course, you know, what did Packer say about scholars and homosexuals? I mean, you know, so there really is an assault on folks that have differing opinions and differing viewpoints that the brethren or folks who are interpreting the brethren's thoughts seem to identify with, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure. The listener can probably guess, our topic tonight is on Mormonism and race and its history with race. Now, Darren, you don't sound like you're from Scandinavia.
No. I actually avoided that in my biology. I was actually born in Nashville, Tennessee. And then I was raised in part in Los Angeles area. And so I'm kind of back and forth. And of course, you may hear a southern drawl there. I don't know if it's one there, but, you know, I lived in Nashville for quite a while. So you may hear maybe a hybrid, accent, perhaps, one that's sort of Utahan mixed with Californian mixed with Tennessean, sort of all kind of mixed up in there. So I hope that's what you're asking me, but if that's the case, then
I'm off
on a tangent.
Well, let's move forward. So I want to kind of pave the road here and let's talk about what Mormons believe and have believed and all that stuff mixed together. Now, a lot of Mormons today will tell you that, you know, the church has distanced itself from all of its racist past. And I think for the large part, that's true. I don't think the Mormons, let me say it this way, are any more or less sort of racist than your standard average American of the same socioeconomic education level. So I
don't know about that.
You would disagree? I mean, because if you...
Well, there's actually some evidence on that. That statement is not made out of context. I mean, that's actually evidence on that. And you're right. I mean, the data does reveal that Mormons are no more racist than any other religious group, given the same circumstances and class dynamics that you just mentioned. So that actually is a statement of fact. In fact, it was done back. That first study was done by Armin Moss. You folks may be familiar with Armin Moss.
Yeah, definitely.
Who did a very good study that looked at that back probably 20, 30 years ago. And I'm recently doing a survey on the same question. And I can tell you in my data, it's the same thing. It hasn't changed much.
You know, there's pockets of racism, obviously, but there's pockets of racism everywhere. And anybody who's been on a foreign mission or otherwise spent time overseas can tell you that Americans are not unique in racist views. I mean, this is a global phenomenon, you know, that it just people tend to it's an us and them thing. And, of course, race and culture and language tend to mark us and them more so than anything else. So it's just easy for human beings to fall into that paradigm.
Well, racism is part of the American story, and here we are talking about the so-called American religion. I mean, it goes without saying that they go hand in hand. I mean, I think that's part of the context that we need to look at here is, you know, the founding of the church in 1830 and the run up to its rise is, you know, antebellum, you know, pre-Civil War, slavery is an institution in the United States. I mean, there couldn't be a more, visible sign of racism than the institution of slavery. And so that's part of the American context and part of the American history in which all of this is going on. Now, does that excuse the way the church is today? That's something we can talk about later, but you know, certainly this is all part of the American story.
Right, right. And I want to go just kind of add on to what you just said. Is that Christian who was talking?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I want to just kind of add on to what you were saying because you're right. I mean, American racism is as old and as American as apple pie. I mean, 400 plus odd years since this country was so-called discovered and slave laws began to creep up on the books around 1640 to where we are currently, America has essentially been a racial oligarchy, if you will. I mean, some of the more egregious overt acts of racial animus have been better policed legally, per se, but still the practices of racism are deeply embedded in the social institutions that make up America, including the church. And that's what people don't understand, is that some folks, at least a lot of you know, well-meaning Mormons, feel that the church has moved beyond that. Well, you can rhetorically move beyond racism, but the vestiges of it are still embedded in the very practices that you're calling under question. That's what's not happened yet in the church. The church continues to placate this and continues to hope that it dies a natural death, hope that it just sort of goes away, or that the lessons learned from Randy Bott, the recent incident that occurred a couple of weeks ago or months ago, are isolated incidences and just random acts that people like Randy Bott and others may sort of, you know, get the racial Holy Ghost and begin talking, speaking in tongues in the way in which Randy Bott did. But the church does not anticipate that those kinds of events will occur because it's never really owned up to its past. And that's part of the problem, unfortunately.
Well,
I was going to just make this one last point. When we talk about racism, we have to be clear what we're talking about. We're talking about a large organized system that categorizes population groups, right, into races, and then marks those groups by preferentially allocating social goods and resources to one group regarded as superior to another group that's regarded as inferior. So we're talking about a system. And then we're talking about the instantiation of practices within that system, whether it be prejudice or whether it be individual acts of meanness, i.e. most people think racism is exactly that. If I hate you or name call, if I call you the N-word and you call me another word, then that's racism. It's reduced down to individual acts of meanness. What we're talking about, I believe, in this podcast is something much more systemic. I heard the host mention global. This is a global phenomena. This is not just about isolated incidences. And as Christian argued earlier, and I want to underscore this once more and say that the Mormon Church is a wonderful microcosm to look at racism and race relations in America. Because if you look at the history of the church and where it went after the death of Joseph Smith, you've got one group essentially developing an entirely different church. And you have, of course, the evolution of the current mainline LDS church, the one we're talking about currently. And look at those two trajectories and how both institutions evolved essentially independent of one another. It's entirely a different, entirely different processes and evolutions when you consider the schism within the Mormon Church. So racism is, in terms of its influence in the church, is highly embedded. Its history is a part of and runs throughout the history of racism in America, which is so interesting to me as someone who's interested in studying it, but also someone who's trying to make sense of it as my practice waxes and wanes at times.
Well, and what I was going to say is, even though the church has put a lot of its racism behind it or tried to move forward from it, there is still a lot of racism in the LDS scriptures.
Yeah, let's go back and see the foundation. I think that was a great introduction to sort of where we are today. But there's reasons that with the LDS Church, the racism is particularly hard to deal with. And, you know, it has to do with the concept of revelation and scripture inside the church. And so let's kind of go back and give an overview of where these doctrines came from. Now, of course, you know, Mormon came to light in the mid early 19th century. And, a lot of the teachings and thoughts about racism that showed up in the scriptures in the Book of Mormon or in the Book of Abraham or in their interpretation of the Bible were very common ideas at the time. So I just want to put that out there, saying that as far as the racism goes, you know, Joseph Smith wasn't necessarily that innovative, that these ideas were around, and you'll still find them entrenched, scriptorial racist notions entrenched in some other fundamentalist and evangelical sects out there today who still hold to these sort of things. But from a scriptorial point of view, the idea of race as a marker or indicator of, say, wickedness or unrighteousness starts with the teachings about Cain. Cain, of course, was the son of Adam, who in the Bible slayed his brother Abel, and so God puts a mark on him. And I think that's all the Bible says. It says a mark. But that has been widely interpreted among our more racist brethren of being a dark skin or blackness. And as a matter of fact, I have here the LDS Bible Dictionary in front of me. And this is the verse on Ham. Now, Ham is the son of Noah, who, according to LDS teaching, married a dark-skinned or a black woman, and by him the curse was preserved in the land, because of course everybody's wiped out except Noah's descendants. And the LDS Bible Dictionary that is in the scriptures right today, if you go down to Deseret Book and buy it, it says the names of his descendants are given in verse. They were the southern nations. Cush is equal to the dark-skinned race of eastern Africa and southern Arabia. Miserium is equal to Egyptians. Phut is equal to Libyans. Cana is equal to inhabitants of Palestine before arrival of the Semitic races. So it's still in the scripture, in the LDS canon, that these things are directly identified with dark-skinned folks in the world today. And so the Book of Abraham, so you have the mark put on Cain, who has descendants down to Noah, and then the Egyptian race, according to the Book of Abraham, descends from Ham, and when Abraham goes into Egypt, the Pharaoh wants the priesthood, but they can't get the priesthood because they're black. And so it very clearly in the scriptures, which are canonized today, says that because of this skin tone, they're unable to receive the priesthood. Now, I'll already throw a bone to my apologist friends, because what they will say is the dark skin was a mark of the curse and not the curse in and of itself. But, you know, that's...
Well, in the Book of Abraham, chapter 1, verses, I think it's verse 24, from Ham sprang that race which preserved the curse in the land. And earlier it was talking about the blood of the Canaanites was preserved in the land. So that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, and this part here, I mean, it's very explicit in LDS teaching, but that idea that those of African descent came from Cain is not a uniquely LDS idea. I do want to emphasize that.
That was floating around back in Joseph Smith's day with other groups too. But wouldn't you said that this was the first kind of mention of race within Mormonism? But the Book of Mormon came first.
Well, I'm talking first in terms of the.
It goes all the way back to Cain.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Book of Mormon. Okay, so the Book of Mormon, of course, published in 1830, in my mind, and I'll allow y'all to argue with me, has at its core sort of this fundamental racist teaching dealing with the American Indians or the Lamanites. I guess we no longer as readily identify them as Lamanites, but for 150 years, American Indians and Lamanites were synonymous. And the idea is Laman and Lemuel, the sons of Lehi, rebelled against Nephi, the rightful heir. And because of that, they were cursed with a dark skin. And according to the Book of Mormon, the dark skin is so that they would not be desirable to their white brethren. So the fundamental idea is that not only is the dark skin a mark of unrighteousness, but it makes darker skinned people, not sexy to white people. I guess that they don't want to intermix. And the Book of Mormon goes back and forth and back and forth and oftentimes throws that word dark in with words like loathsome and filthy. I do think that was a common sort of belief in the 19th century. And I have in my hand here this book called You and the Destiny of the Indian, which was published in 1966 by Dean L. Larson. Dean was a educator and Mormon writer. And so he's trying to justify the sort of Book of Mormon teaching. And he says here, this is on page 51, Indians tend to look upon white men with mistrust and to suspect their motives. The white man, judging the Indian by non-Indian standards, has come to regard him as shiftless, improvident, and inferior. I mean, those sort of ideas that not only was there the dark skin, but dark-skinned people, be they, you know, of African descent or Indian or whatever else, were seen in the church as inferior and
uncomely
and somehow not as righteous or as good as white folks.
Let me just mention that it's amazing to me that I grew up reading the Book of Mormon, attending seminary, attending, you know, Sunday school, gospel doctrine, whatever, and never really, I'm ashamed to say this, never really fully made the connection of how racist this was that I was reading.
I didn't either.
I was reading.
Looking back, I actually bought what I was reading, and therefore I was a racist growing up. That's what I was taught. That's how I was taught to view the world.
And I always had problems with the racism or the race issue in the church. We can talk about it more later, but it never, you know, with the blacks and the priesthood issue, but I never quite connected. I don't know how I missed it. These teachings are embedded within the Book of Mormon. And in one of the many interviews that Brian Keith Dalton has given, aka Mr. Deity, who grew up Mormon, he said that was the fundamental issue that drove him out of the church is the racist teachings of the Book of Mormon. And I had long since abandoned, you know, belief in the church and all that, you know, for lots of reasons. But it was one of the first times where I thought, wow, the racism is right in the Book of Mormon, not in all of this other, you know, the racist quotes that you can dredge up about from Brigham Young all the way down to Ezra Taft Benson and everyone in between. It's right there in the Book of Mormon. Right. And, it really is astonishing to me that we, you know, hold up this book, you know, the quote unquote most perfect book, you know, that we can have and not make this connection. And I suspect that there's lots of people like me who have read it over and over and never made that connection. I don't know. I don't know how to make sense of that, but I'll throw that out there.
Yeah. Well, it's what you were raised with. So it's hard to see it from any other perspective than it being holy, the book. Can I read one of the verses that's a good example in the Book of Mormon about what we're talking about? Alma chapter 3, verse 6. And the skins of the Lamanites were dark, according to the mark which was set upon their fathers, which was a curse upon them because of their transgression and their rebellion against their brethren. So I don't know how you could look at the Book of Mormon, especially the main story of the Book of Mormon which is sort of explains how the Native Americans can be Jewish and yet have dark skin. And the reason why they have dark skin is because they were disobedient and wicked, and God cursed them with a dark skin. And so anybody who tries to say, no, the Book of Mormon is not racist, that's not the kind of the main thread of the Book of Mormon. I really think that it is.
Well, you don't even have to read clear into Alma. And for those who, you know, forget Alma's, you know, halfway into the Book of Mormon. I mean, right there in First Nephi, there's mentions of white, you know, white being equated with beauty and perfection and darkness being, you know, not, you know, desirable. And I guess in my, you know, as I think more about this with the Book of Mormon, I mean, lots of us do the same thing with the Bible. We read it and don't realize the incongruencies, the inconsistencies, you know, the racism that's in the Bible.
And the horrible things like killing all of the babies during the flood. I mean, you know, just things that as I was growing up, I never even considered twice and really thought through all of the implications of.
Right.
So, what's interesting now is the practice. So there was sort of that very paternalistic view from the, get-go. And, you know, like we've said in the beginning, racism was common. If you want to be ashamed of the racism of your, grandfathers, go right ahead because you're in good company, like everybody else in the whole world. But I think one thing that's interesting is, you know, it was being said before that I think Zilpha just said that, you know, she realized she grew up racist. I realized that I grew up racist also because of these teachings. Now, I graduated from high school in 91. So when the 1978 ban was overturned, which we'll talk about in a minute here, I was just a kid. I was just like 5 years old. So for me, ostensibly, my whole career in the church, there was no overt practice of racism in terms of the priesthood or the temple and all that stuff. That was ancient history for me. But there was still this paternalistic view that was very common that white is better than black. White is better than Indian. And I mean, we were overtly taught in seminary when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s that when people became righteous, they turned white, you know, and when they went to heaven, they would be white. So
that our spirits are white and a glorified resurrected body would be white.
And my mother, bless her heart, she taught me that you should not have interracial marriage.
My dad taught me that too. I thought he was silly for saying that.
So let's talk a little bit about the practice. This is from John J. Stewart's famous book, Mormonism and the Negro, which was published in 1960 was the original. The edition I have here was printed in 1973. And Stewart was a professor of journalism up at Utah State. And this book was published also with a chapter by William Barrett, who was also a professor. I think he was vice president at Brigham Young University. And he wrote a lot of the manuals that were used in church in Sunday school at the time. But Stewart gives a very good synopsis of the practice. And this is on page 8. He says, briefly, the LDS policy on Negroes is this. Negroes and other people with Negroid blood can become members of the church.
Negroid blood,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay. It's green, right? It's different.
Oh, my
or something.
God.
Yeah.
It's Negroid.
Can become members of the church and through righteous works receive patriarchal blessings, enter the temple to receive baptism for the dead, become heirs to the celestial kingdom, and otherwise partake of many blessings afforded worthy members of the church. But they cannot be ordained to the priesthood, nor are they eligible for marriage in the LDS temple. Negroes and non-Negroes should not intermarry. In regard to this LDS policy on Negroes, members of the church face three alternatives. One, be apologizers for the church, say that it is old-fashioned, outmoded on this point. Prejudice. Two, confess that we do not know the reason for this policy, although we accept it, that we have a blind faith in it. And three, proclaim that it is a correct and reasonable doctrine that is tenable and that we have no reason either to apologize for it nor evade question about it. We must then explain the reason for it and show that it is consistent with the rest of LDS doctrine. The first two alternatives are totally unacceptable to me, which, of course, we have fully embraced now. I'll read you the next paragraph just because it's a kick. If we are apologizing for the church on this point, then we admit, in effect, that all gospel doctrine is not sound. We say, in effect, that either the original position of the church was incorrect on the matter, or if it was correct, that we as a church do not enjoy continuous revelation and thus have become outdated on this doctrine. If we deny continuous revelation in the church, then we place ourselves in much the same position as all other so-called Christian sects and isolate ourselves from God, the head of our church.
So-called Christian sects.
I wanted to read that because the civil rights movement really came into swing in the 50s and was, you know, full on, and basically the battle was won in the 60s. And for most members of the church, I think they found themselves out in the front without cover during the 70s and were embarrassed by the doctrine and, didn't quite know where to go. So when the 1978 revelation came about, it was with sweet relief through the whole church.
Yeah.
Although there were people who left the church, but they were fringers anyway, and there weren't a lot of them.
Yeah, most of the people that we've heard from who were around at the time and you know, aware of the issues were just super happy about it. You know,
Let me ask you, is it okay if I ask you two a question, just out of curiosity?
Yeah.
What does this mean for you to know that the church has a shady past? And I mean, because I hear that you two are absolutely correct in your assessment of the church and its history. I mean, you're not going to hear me say no, I disagree with you here. No, you're not going to hear that because I don't disagree with you. I mean, I totally agree. But I'm curious to know because it's important for other white folks out there who are going to hear this, who may be on the bubble, who are actually Mormons on the edge, or the edge of falling over, or the edge of staying in, if you will. What does this mean for you, or what did it mean for you to discover this?
Well, I'll say for me, John will probably have a different answer for him, because I did grow up racist. It took me a long time to see these things. It was not until after I stopped believing in things like the Book of Abraham as being, you know, legitimate, and the Book of Mormon as being legitimate, that I was actually able to see them for what they were and to actually read their words instead of trying to get some spiritual experience out of them. So my faith was already gone by the time I could see these things.
I had struggled with them from the time I was in high school. I mean, I recognized the teaching to be false. And I remember my brother... This is how I remember it. My brother came home when I was in junior high one time. We were at the dinner table, and he said that his seminary teacher taught them that day that heaven was about to run out of black babies and that, white children would soon be being born to black families, which was a sign of the end times. Because, of course, the racist teaching behind that was sort of a post hoc justification for it. Which is, if you look at it and say God's fair and God's just, but there's people on this earth who are born into less desirable circumstance, there has to be a justification, and the Mormon justification was, of course, the pre-existence.
They did something wrong, or they weren't as faithful.
So, but this errant seminary teacher was saying, "Hey, we're going to run out of those
naughty spirits." And then everybody will be born white.
And even though I'm like 14 or 15 at the time, I can just recognize how absurd that teaching is. It's just way off the deep end in terms of nuts. So for me, to sort of avail myself of that, not have to apologize for it, since I'm no longer a believing member, is very much relief, because it was always in tension. And I think for most Mormons, like I say, there is tension there. But I am troubled still by the fact that Mormonism has it so ingrained that it's not so easy to do away with. And I think the church does itself a disservice by just saying in Hinckley fashion, that's the old days. We're done with that. We've moved on. In my opinion, the church has not moved on because it's still there in the scriptures. And I think what the church needs is a very, very strong apology. And they need to doctrinally somehow explain how these prophets, seers, and revelators came to this. Now, I don't think that's a mission impossible. I think you can come to that and say, you can come up with an answer.
Well, you could just do what they've done in the past and just take those things out and pretend they were never there.
You could do that, but...
I mean, I don't know really why they don't do that. I guess maybe piece by piece, you know, line upon line, they take them out line
because
upon line.
Because I think, you say, why don't they do it? I think that most Mormons at that level, especially because this is an older generation, right? We're talking about, you know, the 70s and the 12. They still have that paternalistic...
Well, and then think about racism. It. How do you get rid of the racism out of the Book of Mormon? You really can't, because you have... Okay, so you have these Lamanites, right? Well, they came from Jerusalem. How did they get dark?
Yeah, well,
you can't get rid of it.
I think maybe they're trying that. Now they're trying to distance themselves and not say, you know, it's taboo now to say American Indians are Lamanites, right?
Yeah,
so
but
I think that's one step, because then they can say, I don't know that the skin of darkness is, you know, Navajo, you know, phenotype or whatever. I don't know. It's extremely difficult. And the current policy, if you read the manuals right now, is just to try to plow around it and not acknowledge it and hope nobody catches on.
Well, that would be a huge problem, you know, for the church. I mean, in the sense that. So I think someone raised the question earlier. Christian, just hop in. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, whoever that was.
I just wanted to chime in on your question. To be honest, growing up in Kaysville, Utah, I had extremely limited interaction with African-Americans. To me, African-Americans were the Cosbys on Thursday night. It was Carl Malone on the Utah Jazz. I mean, so it wasn't something I actually thought much about. Then when in high school, I moved to New Hampshire, and New Hampshire isn't exactly a diverse place, but to a kid from Davis County, having several African-American classmates was quite diverse. And so I suddenly started thinking about this, and that's when I started to wrestle with it was back there in high school. And like John and Zilpha, you know, now that I'm, you know, out of, you know, any kind of belief in the church, it's a relief to not have to try and explain this. But I spent years trying to wrestle with it and try and come to terms with, well, if I'm a believing Mormon, how do I accept that this is part of Mormonism? And it was a real struggle. And I still remember one lunch where I went with a fellow, you know, kind of liberal Mormon who was struggling in the same sort of way. And I said, well, how do we deal with this? And he said, well, Christian, it was just wrong. It was just wrong of the church to do this. And I said, and it was like, well, if it was wrong, then how can the church be right in anything else if it got this big, huge, fundamental thing wrong? It's nice to not have to apologize or dance around it anymore. I just, you know, can call it like it is, or at least the way I see it.
You know, John, you mentioned the pre-existence thing.
Yes, the pre-existence.
Well, you know, Marky Peterson is well known for some kooky remarks, but there is a great one that he, when he was talking to the Convention of Teachers of Religion at BYU, 1954, he said, "The Lord segregated the people both as to blood and place of residence. At least in the cases of Lamanites and the Negroes, we have the definite word of the Lord himself that he placed a dark skin upon them as a curse, as a punishment, and as a sign to all others. He forbade intermarriage with them under threat of extension of the curse. And he certainly segregated the descendants of Cain when he cursed the Negro as to the priesthood and drew an absolute line. But what does the mercy of God have for him? This Negro, who in the pre-existence lived the type of life which justified the Lord in sending him to the earth in the lineage of Cain with a black skin, and possibly being born in darkest Africa, if that Negro is willing when he hears the gospel to accept it, he may have the blessings of the gospel. In spite of all he did in the pre-existence life, the Lord is willing, if the Negro accepts the gospel with real sincere faith and is really converted, to give him the blessings of baptism and the gift of the Holy Ghost. If that Negro is faithful all his days, he can and will enter the celestial kingdom. He will go there as a servant, but he will get celestial resurrection."
Yikes. 1954. Well, I mean, how does the church reconcile those incredibly offensive, incredibly racist ideas? I mean, how does it profess to proselytize amongst folks who look like me when the institution itself has these kinds of just horrible notions? I mean, how does it do that? How is it able to make that argument stick?
Well, how old were you when you were baptized?
I was 15. I knew nothing about this.
Well, there you go. That's how they do it.
Yeah, but that's not a very good solution.
No, but that's how they do it, is they hope that people won't dig in any deeper than the manuals and stuff that they hear on Sunday.
But that's incredibly naive, because it's so much a part of the church. It's so much a part, and people say some dumb stuff in quorum meetings or in Sunday school. People say some dumb stuff, so I can't imagine that this doesn't come up.
And that's when you're there and they're being guarded, right?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Can imagine. You know, that is a great question, and I think part of the answer lies in Zilpha and I. A few years ago, moved out to North Carolina. We lived in Wilmington, and there was. I picked up, when we were moving out, a book called North Carolina for Newcomers. I was amazed that there was an entire chapter on the dark history of race relations. And then we went to the local museum, and there was a whole section on lynching. They had photographs, and they had talked about race riots and lynchings that had happened in the city. And there was a whole room that they had. They'd set up a mock school room from the 50s, and they had it divided right down the middle. So the left side of the room was set up as a white school, and the right side of the room is set up as a black school. So you could see starkly, you know, the difference in the desks and the decoration and the floorboards and just everything. But the point is that the South still has a long ways to go, no doubt. But they embraced their history.
They don't embrace it. They acknowledge it.
Well, they at least that's an excellent point, Silva. But they at least acknowledge it. They don't try to pretend it's not there. If you go to the Church History Museum in Salt Lake or any of the museums, try to find any mention. You know, try to find mention of the fact that Utah was a slave state and the Brigham Young and others owned slaves, or other, you know, other such things. They just try to completely whitewash it out. So the question is a fascinating one. How does the church deal with it? And right now, they're not. And that's why we have the problems we have today.
And the reasons that they won't deal with it, do you think have more to do with there's a concept known as interest convergence, where in other words, where the benefits or the risks of policing one's practices, right, outweigh the benefits to the institution because of the money that it gets in for spiritual, you know, for tax, for tithing dollars. And so, I mean, is there a connection between those two? I'm curious. I don't know. Is there a reason why the church doesn't do anything about it?
That's what they're afraid of.
Kristen, you were going to say something.
Well, you asked how the church deals with it. And the way I dealt with it, at least in high school, was, you know, as I was struggling with this, lo and behold, here comes to our ward in New Hampshire an African-American missionary, Elder Van Dyke. And I asked him directly, I said, you know, how do you deal with official declaration number 2, which is the strange way that I put it? And he said, well, I don't understand everything. And you know, so so one day I'll understand. I thought, well, if he doesn't have an issue with it, then certainly I, you know, have no right or standing, as you might put it, to have an issue with it. And, you know, that's one of the things that always puzzles me is, and I'd love to track him down and see how he feels about it now. But on the few occasions that I do attend the ward here, you know, for something that my kids are doing or something here in South Carolina, and I'll say an African American family, I want to ask them, how do you reconcile this? I don't go to church to be on the offensive, so I don't ask them that. But I think that the presence of you know, they can point to these, you know, African Americans in the church and say, look, we don't have a big problem. We have African American members, and so if, you know, if they don't have a problem with it, why are you making a stink out of it?
Well, I think the kind of African Americans that the church, and we're talking about, remember, in terms of folks of African descent, the majority of members in the United States so far appears to be folks who claim to be African American or whose ancestors were transported from Africa and ended up here in this country. So, but although there are obviously there are Afro-Haitians who are Mormon, there are Africans who are Mormon, and so on and so forth. But in this country, North American blacks are those who identify as African-American, are those people whose ancestors were here. So having said that, a lot of African-Americans that join the church, the LDS church currently, tend to be middle class or upward middle class, upwardly mobile, used to being in highly integrated areas with whites. So these are very different kind of black folks that the church tends to proselytize. These are black people who are very used to being around white circles. They're not very good code switchers. I'll say that. But these are individuals who are used to being around whites and in white spaces, and they tend to make better converts. That where the church has more problems in terms of its proselytizing of black folks happen to be working class black folks who have very differing ideas about religious persuasions and religious practices. And the LDS church way of practice is very hostile and alien to them in terms of their call and African-American call and response tradition that you would generally see in a black church. But there's some cultural mismatches that goes on between middle class, working class blacks and what white work and white middle class folks or even upper white middle class, the church culture is primarily middle to upper middle class white, the sort of culture of the church, if you will. Of course, the practices of the church come from that early Protestant Methodist kind of moment that Joseph Smith was sort of transformed by when he had the first vision, or allegedly had his first vision, according to some folks. So the church hasn't had much success amongst blacks. I will say that. Okay, the Pew research, they suggest 3% of folks who are Mormon identify as black.
In America.
But I don't know how they get this data. I don't know how Pew gets the data. Because the church proclaims it doesn't keep records on that. So I don't know how they tabulate or formulate that particular number. It sounds believable. Especially when you base it off 9 million people is what they're basing that figure off of. So it's a very different kind of black folk that the church actually proselytized. Have you folks had an opportunity? I actually wrote a blog about Mia Love. Oh, you know who she is or heard of her before?
I haven't.
If you haven't heard of Mia Love, Mia Love is actually an African-American woman. I mean, let me retract that. She is an Afro-Haitian woman who lives in Saratoga Springs, Utah.
Really? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have heard of her.
Okay. Now, the Republicans are rallying behind her and this and that and the other. There's a whole... You know, I have a problem with all that, but it's neither here nor there. But the point is, her identity politics fascinates me, where she's black, she's a woman, and she's LDS. I call it that trifecta of oppression, because she has all three class markers that have been historically oppressed in a patriarchal and a racist and a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm.
So she's got all the three markers. And so I talk about her experience in these blogs. I think it's important. I think it really explains well this particular fast conversation we're having regarding black Americans, the type of black Americans that would tend to belong to the Mormon church. And I would tell you that it's not been a critical mass movement of blacks into the church. I'll tell you that first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks do convert to the LDS church. They generally don't stay.
So you were saying, I think I was talking over you when you said about Mia. She's running for mayor, right?
No, she already became mayor of Saratoga Springs.
Okay.
She already finished out her term. Now she's running for Congress.
Okay.
She's trying to unseat Matheson.
So Jim Utah Matheson. Congress?
Yeah.
That's
and cool. So Matheson has a war chest. He has about he has close to $1 million just dedicated running a campaign here in Utah. Now Mia has gotten a lot of support from all of these right wing nuts and teabaggers across the country. I feel very strongly that she's being used, like most black folks are, by the Republican, by the right, for nefarious reasons. But anyway, it's an interesting blog about her, and it really tries to sort of capture the essence of who would tend to join the Mormon church. Now, what I find interesting about the conversations I'm having with you three, and this is something that I want to put out there, and you know, I'll let you respond to it. But it is so rare when you said it's Zophie, right?
Zophie.
When you said you were a racist, that's sweet music to my ears. And the reason why I say that is because it's hard to get white folks to understand what racism is, let alone recognize how they benefit from racism. Obviously, you're acknowledging, yes, I'm a racist because I've been socialized to view people as being inferior and others as being superior. And theology has been the conduit there, at least one conduit by which racism sort of rears its ugly head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a rare moment when a white person says, I'm a racist. I'm a professor, recovering racist, I'll even add. And this is what I'm doing to reconcile that. So my question to you two, you three, I'll just say it out there. Don't you think it would be better? And I know you have explanations for Bobby. I'd love to hear this. Don't you think it would be better to stay in the church and be a damn irritant to the throngs of racists that occupy and sit their asses in those seats, those wooden seats on any given Sunday across the country?
You want us to be the fifth column?
I have no problem irritating Mormons, but I've chosen a different path for irritation.
Well, just imagine if everybody who felt like we did, instead of staying in, and that sort of supports the institution, if everybody left.
That's a wonderful way to reframe the question that I just asked.
Well, to go back to Karen's question, there are those who stay in and irritate. And I was one of those for a long time, as a so-called Sunstone Mormon or Dialogue Mormon or Liberal Mormon or whatever term you want to use. And I think that that's ultimately an ineffective route. I just don't think the church can malign and ignore those types of Mormons or and kind of brush them to the side and continue on its way. So, I just figure, there's lots of other reasons that I don't believe in the church. This is certainly one of the big ones, but, I think Zilpha is right. Like, what if everyone just said, okay, enough of this. We're going to step away from it. And if we still have faith in God, we're going to go to another church. And if we don't, we're going to find something else to do with our time, either through humanism or service or something else.
But I do like the point you're trying to make, and I think there are people who do that, and I would encourage them to do so, to agitate for change.
Especially if they still have a fundamental belief in Mormonism, but they just think that somehow this thing is wrong, then don't just sit in the pews quietly about it. Say something.
Right, because Darren, you pointed out something that I want to circle back and underline. That if you are willing to take on the behavioral patterns and the politics and the social aspect of this white middle-class church, you are embraced with open arms. I mean, look at not to pick on her, but I don't want to pick on Gladys Knight. I want to talk about the way she was accepted.
Please pick on Gladys Knight. That's fine.
Well, you had all these folks that would never in a million years buy an R&B album, right? But they started selling a Deseret Book, and people bought them up because there was, I think, an element of this white guilt. But I think there's this reverse racism in it, which is, We love whoever you are as long as you're going to be just like us. We're not going to embrace the other. And I've said before, I think we talk about racism, and it's probably a little bit of a wrong term. I think most people are more culturists. They don't like other people's cultures. And I think what you're talking about is an embracing of a more pluralism, that there are valid ways that, let's say, traditional African-American churches worship God. Which is culturally significant to them. And, we've all heard the old story about, at least people on the edge of the church, about the churches going into Africa and telling them, you can't use drums, you can't use anything else. Here is a Casio keyboard. Play this funeral dredge, music from the 19th century. It just doesn't take. And I think there's still that cultural imperialism that is really prevalent in the church, and which is, hey, I mean, there's like two or three African Americans in the Tabernacle Choir, and they get like 70% of the camera time. So I think that the church loves themselves an African American as long as they're going to be just like us,
John, I love you, man.
Every time that you see something from conference or the Deseret News, there is that little. The clips of the four African Americans at conference. It's like, oh, look, it's such a diverse church. These make up like less than 1% of the people there. But hey, look, we're going to make it look like they make up 40% or, something like that.
I was going to say that, what's funny is that we talk about, you mentioned Africa and some of the churches,
missionary efforts abroad. You know, the notion that the church is one of the fastest growing churches in the U.S. is really a misnomer, because when you look at the actual growth of churches across the country, or at least across the world, and we look at American-based churches, at least anyway, the LDS church, comparatively speaking to other evangelical sects, the evangelical churches tend to have more growth than the LDS church. The reason for that, and I think that is the same reason for the Catholics, the decline of the Catholics, the growth of Catholicism in like Latin America and some other places, because it's too damn conservative. People want to express their devotion to deity in the ways that are, like as you indicated, John, that are more culturally appropriate for them. And the church blunts that, right? The church renders that impotent. And so people are worshiping in ways that are not natural to their cultural identity, their historical traditions, and so on and so forth. And so that's one of the reasons why I believe that the church is not as appealing to more traditional African Americans. It's because partly the way in which the church worships, the way in which the saints do their thing, which is they use these very Protestant-like hymns and very old meter type music, old English type music that nobody can identify with, other than I guess people who are white whose ancestors came from old England.
Well, even then, there's a reason why BlackBerry sales are very high in Utah. I think it's time for a revamping. I don't care what culture you come from.
Well, I agree, John. I agree, and I think that apart from the theological position that the church has maintained, and the church, and as you folks have indicated before, I can't add much to what you've already done. You've done a wonderful job of actually using evidence based. I want to tell your audience, evidence based literature to refute the theological nonsense the church has put forward for I don't know how many 130 some odd years. Okay, so. You've been able to do that in a matter of 20 minutes, okay? Being able to refute that stuff, because if you look at it at face value, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's absolutely, and people believe that stuff. People do believe it. People believe it, deeply believe, to such an extent to where they would be willing to go to actually lay down their lives for it, if you will.
Yeah,
which is the scary part.
This, of course, circles us back to sort of where we started, which I think is a good place to sort of finish out the discussion, which is we acknowledge that there's this sort of scriptorial basis for it and this doctrinal basis, and a lot of traditions have been able to move away from that and sort of repent. The churches have been able to repent to That's some right. extent or the other. The problem that the LDS culture has and the LDS church has is I think the majority, the vast majority, easily above 80%, would love to just, you know, scrap all of the vestiges of racism. Of course, as we've talked about, some of those are pretty ironed into folks' outlook on the world, and it's hard. But I think the people want to do that. But the church has a problem of how do you preserve the doctrine of apostleship and authority and the structure of the church, meanwhile acknowledging that not only were the brethren wrong on an issue, they were profoundly wrong, and they were wrong in the most serious ways. They were, because the enzyme today, there's a reason, I've said this lots of times before, there's a reason you can't go on to LDS.org and get enzyme magazines before 1971, because they are hysterically, in a very sad way, provincial, racist, conventional wisdom of the time. They're just jaw-droppingly simple-minded in terms of what these guys were saying. And the church.
Do you have any copies of that stuff, by the way?
I've got lots of copies of that stuff.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we've got.
Okay, now let me put this out there. I'll go ahead and announce this, but I'll just say it. But you know, I'm actually working on a book right now.
Great.
That looks specifically at the history of the church, its position, of course, its racist position that led to the riots that went on. The NCAA riots that went on, protesting BYU, the athletic competition. So I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at all of the events that took place back then and currently up to the Brandon Davies issue. Remember the kid that was kicked off the basketball team for having premarital sex?
Right, right.
And so all of that stuff. So this is what I'm looking at. So I would love to see – you can edit this out there too. You can edit this out, John, if you want. But I'd love to see whatever you have pre-1970.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, we can talk about that some more. But
excellent.
It's sort of knuckleheaded stuff, you know. It's stuff that you would read in Reader's Digest from the same time. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like
these
guys.
No. Now remember that article that was written about the Native Americans in the program where they would go into the, and I believe it was in the Ensign.
Yeah, well, the Ensign started in 1971. So it was the Improvement Era, 1960, where Spencer Kimball said that the Navajo who were in the Indian Placement Program,
and the LDS families,
were turning white.
Yeah, like he said, I know of an example where the sister was in the placement program and she is lighter than her brother who stayed on the reservation.
I mean, the racism is incredible. I mean, you talk about cultural racist, right? That's John, I've heard you refer to that. I mean, typically in sociological circles, we refer to it as cultural racism, right? But you're talking, we're speaking the same language, but
it's just out there. The church, whether or not you believe the church is true, the church needs to repent.
But how do they repent for their main scripture? How do they do that?
That's a toughie, because there's apologetic ways to get around the teaching about Ham and the Pearl of Great Price. I mean, the rest of it's bullshit anyway, the Pearl of Great Price, right? But the Book of Mormon, it's sort of like we tend to focus in on the race issue with African Americans, which I don't mean to minimize. It's a huge problem. But the racism with the Indians is still there, and
absolutely,
it basically
and
hasn't
blatant,
gone away.
Blatant.
Yeah.
And I think the negativity associated with African Americans is obvious. I mean, the way in which African Americans have been demonized in the church and with all of the folklore associated with it. John, it goes back to what you said again. I want to keep tapping in your words. It's almost this benevolent, patriarchal, or paternalistic, we know what's good for you.
Yes.
Why do we know? Because we're better than you. Why? Because God said that blah, 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 blah. And God said that you were cursed with a dart. So it's all of this sort of gendered testosterone mixed with this sort of racist, I'm better than you kind of notion. And it's all rolled up into, and sadly, into a, well, I will say this. Let me say this. Isn't it funny? You all have heard this before. Christian, I know you've heard this too. The church is uniquely American church. You've heard that before, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and the reason why is because unlike other churches that started as a schism from another mainline church, the church evolved just sort of out of that, okay? So it's pure Americana in the sense that you can sort of follow a trajectory of social behaviors and social patterns in the church for 100 and some odd years in terms of traditional roles of women, attitudes and beliefs about blacks, attitudes and beliefs about Indians, Native American folks. You can sort of see the evolution of the church's racist,
misogynistic.
Yes, all of that stuff evolve. It sort of evolve into what it is currently. It's much more benevolent, much more overt. Much more covert, but it's still there. It's ubiquitous. It's still there, very much there. So that's what's troubling about it. And you mentioned to me that you say, well, the church has to repent. Well, I've been saying that shit for a long time, pardon my language. I've been saying that for years, that the church is so busy teaching its members that they ought to be atoning and that they ought to be repenting, that it fails as an institution to set the example of what a repentance looks like. But the church is too busy protecting its coffers. Mm-hmm. And protecting the sensibilities of white members and while throwing black members under the bus and Native Americans under the bus. Isn't it ironic that those who most often have to apologize for the church's racist positions are not white members, right, but yet black members who are always put in a position where they have to justify their existence to why they belong to the church in the first place, and it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Black folks don't go to church to teach white folks about how to be human. They go to church to worship the Lord, to worship God, to worship deity, the way in which white folks do it. But yet blacks have this added burden to carry around with them that no one seems to appreciate, no one seems to give a shit about, save a few handful here and there, whose voices are marginalized and pushed to the side, much like black folks who care about this issue deeply. And so it's really quite unfortunate. And I'm on my soapbox. I'll be quiet now. Go ahead.
Speaking of soapbox, I was at the Utah Valley University Mormon Studies Conference about a month or so ago, And the head guy of Fair.
Scott Gordon?
Yeah. He was there, and he was basically accusing ex-Mormons and anti-Mormons of using black people and this issue just to get to the church. So he was saying, well, at least we're not using, you know, black people.
Scott Gordon said that, huh?
Yes.
So should we just ignore the issue of race and just go on our merry way? Is that what he's hoping for?
I think he wants people to not talk about it.
Yeah, there's so many things they just want to go away. But, you know, Darren, to what you're saying, I actually, you know, here's more guilt. I actually felt a little guilty about bringing somebody like yourself on for that very reason, that I didn't want you to feel like you were in a position to defend something that in my mind is completely undefensible. And I feel sorry for a lot of folks out there, as you point out, that they're in a position stuck between this church that they have to apologize for on the outside and on the inside. It is a tough, tough position to be in.
But that they love, you know.
Or, yeah, at least enough to stay involved, yeah.
Is it okay here's what I do. I have stopped making excuses for it. I don't do it anymore. I used to do that. I was trying to do the right, you know, quote unquote, do the right thing and all that. But I just decided that for my own sanity and my own sense of self, personal well-being, psychological well-being, if you will, and healthy fitness, that kind of stuff, knowing what I know, is just completely, complete bull crap. And I just, I will not placate or participate in anything that marginalizes an entire group of people and that throws an entire group of people under the bus. And the church really has to forthrightly apologize. And what's interesting about that statement is that when you mentioned the church needs to issue a formal apology, it seems to me that a lot of people in this survey that I don't know if you folks know about the survey that's going on right now, that's analyzing racial attitudes in the church, in the LDS church, seeing how people think about race and so on and so forth. The vast majority of people in this survey believe the church needs to go further. The church has not gone far enough in its repudiation of its racist teachings. Now, it goes back to what your wife said earlier, and everybody has mentioned here, you know, within this panel, this in order for the church to go on record to clean up practices, to purge the racist elements and the teachings that it has obviously it has investments in, would take a fundamental shift in ideology by the brethren and other church stakeholders, and I just don't see that happening anytime soon. I really don't. I mean, I think it's in the church's best interest to continue to play, a hide and go seek with this issue, you know, and deal with it on a onesies twosies basis when someone like Randy Bott, you know, starts spewing racist lore about black folks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think until there's a major crisis in the church, I don't see that happening anytime soon. The church will continue its current position, will just do nothing, say nothing. If I ignore it, it'll go away.
And that's
served the church well for many, many years. I mean, right. I mean, think about it. It's been a pretty effective strategy.
Right, but they weren't anticipating Google.
No.
But I still say they can't apologize too far because
they can and they will. And I agree with Darren. They're going to ride the wave as long as they possibly can. But who would have ever thought that the 2002 presidential election would come down between an African American and a Mormon?
Isn't that crazy?
And you know the strategists are waiting until the end of the summer to bring out the big guns. It's like a fireworks show, and the big ones always go off last.
Because I'm ready to talk.
So
I'm sure they call me up because I'm ready to say a few things about this as well. Because I think you're right, but also I think we're marginalizing your voice because I hear what you're saying. And I don't believe in my own heart, they will not apologize. They will not say anything about it. They don't care. If I am struggling with my faith, I'm in a faith crisis because I can't figure out how the hell I could end up in a church that has incredibly racist doctrine. that I've subscribed to for half my damn life, and that's causing me psychological duress. You think they care about that? I mean, they've heard people say, they've heard folks like yourselves who have been begging and pleading, hey, you got to do something here. They don't care. And the reason for it, I believe, is because there's too much at stake. There's theological things at stake for the church. There are financial things at stake. And you already mentioned it. The church has lost an incredible amount of people to Google and the internet, because people are discovering this, and I'm finding this in my survey. People, how did you first learn about this? Over a quarter of people said, "Hey, on the internet, it's all readily available." And then the other 50% said, "Oh, from somebody I know, another church member taught me this stuff." So until white folks, you see, police their practices, until white folks become as outraged about this as you two have, or you three have, Troy, I'm going to throw you in there as well, this is not going to change. Y'all got to get pissed about it, not me. They don't give a shit about what I say. Now, what they care about is when y'all stop paying tithing and y'all say we're done, then the church will pay attention, because at the end of the day, it's a financial organization like anything else. It breathes and lives based on the money it partakes. Now, obviously, it has investments as well, of course. But the influx of cash really is the bread and butter of a capitalistic-oriented religious tradition. Yeah. So until white folks get pissed about this, and that's what I'm saying. This is, you don't have to apologize, John, for inviting me. This is what I do. My area of inquiry is whiteness studies. I study white people. I'm actually in my element right here. and it excites me when I see white folks get pissed about this and say, I'm pissed about this, and then do something about it. I love that. And we don't have enough of that in the LDS church. What ends up happening is that folks like yourselves get so damn pissed off about it, and I'm sure there's other reasons too, y'all leave. Right? Black folks do that too. We leave too. Okay, we don't stay in it. And for good reason. It's righteous indignation. You have a right to say, I can't do this. But then that doesn't leave anybody left to fight. Or what it leaves is people who are very on the fence with it and say, yeah, I know it's wrong, but I'm not gonna throw my name in the ringer just in case the Bureau of Investigation, whoever that organization was, the church hires, you know, looks at me. So when I say and what I said 10 years ago when I tried to get with that group called Mormons for Equality and Social Justice, they called me and asked me if I would come and talk to them, and I did. And I said to myself, here are a group of white folks who are progressive, who are educated, who have obviously, who claim to be about equality. Let's see if they would be willing to do a petition to get the brethren to make. I went to them in sackcloth and ashes, to borrow a metaphor. And they looked at me and said, we ain't going to do that. And I said, well, why not? Well, we don't want to rock the boat. That's what I was told. Well, why are you calling yourselves Mormons for social justice? It was a real letdown.
Because they want it to happen by itself. They don't want to have to.
It's not going to happen by itself.
Sacrifice.
Since when has social change happened by itself and in a vacuum?
I agree.
Well,
I
mean, unfortunately, it doesn't happen. It seems that for cultural reasons or structural reasons or whatever, the change does not seem to come from the inside. And we all know, and I've said this lots of times, that probably Stanford did more to change the race situation than, you know, 100 years of people fighting from the inside. And that's unfortunate. And we got to find a way to change it. So all hands on deck. You know, everyone needs to push on this issue.
Whether you're in or out.
So things there might be changes. Who knows? And I do think the church will cling to it until its last possible breath. Those old guys will hold on till they just can't hold on anymore, just like with Stanford, just like with 78.
But they can't ever truly profess to be non-racist with the Book of Mormon.
No, but
in their
hand. I'll tell them. Okay, here's the end.
That's what I can't understand.
But for everybody listening in the church office building, I'm going to give you the answer. Here it is, right here. You guys all ready? Mm-hmm. So the 12 are prophets, seers, and revelators. You come down from the mountaintop with the tablets and say, we just spoke to God. And God says, this was wrong, and those guys were wrong, and that's the word, and they just change it. You know,
they just say, forget the Book of Mormon.
They have a good get-out-of-jail-free card, is what I'm saying. Is they can say, This is revelation. And the revelation is not that the policy should change. The revelation is the policy was wrong. And it wasn't just a policy. And all these guys were just – they were just wrong. That's what they do.
The members will say, well, how do we know you're not wrong now?
That's right.
They might. But that's why the church will wait to the last possible minute to do it, because there is potential cost. But that's part of repentance. That's part of them saying, we're going to own this problem, and we're going to realize that if there's people who will leave the church because we acknowledge our racist background, see you later. Those aren't the kind of people we want around anyway.
Ooh, hey, y'all giving me the chills up in here. because both of you are speaking truth to power. Both of you are saying the same thing, but in different ways. You know, I happen to believe that the church, and personally, the church will never do anything about it because it's too much at risk. I've already mentioned that. But it's a house of cards. If members of the church are led to believe that the brethren were at the helm of this, that they were prophets, seers, and revelators speaking to God, that God told Joseph Smith and whomever, Brigham Young, that this is the way things were supposed to be, and all of a sudden, right, political pressure or pressure from the outside is pushing the church to make an announcement or making a monumentous statement. Some people are saying that the apology given at for Randy Bott was essentially the closest thing to an apology the church has ever made. I disagree with that.
That wasn't
I totally
an apology.
Disagree with that. I think the church was forced to say something about that. But had Randy Bott not been a religious professor at BYU, the church never would have said a word about it.
True.
I mean, they never said a word about it. You would never have heard about this. People would have been upset about it, but the church would have not issued an apology or issued a statement. It wasn't an apology. It was a statement of clarification. And it was basically, we don't endorse or condone what Dr. Randy Bott had to say about racism. You know, we have always been blah, 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 but they've never quite issued an apology. And I think that goes back to the idea of interest convergence. There's something in it for the church. Right, which is why they don't do it. This is why they don't issue an apology and fundamentally shift its theology and some of the religious rhetoric that remains in print. You're right, in print, it's still there. It hasn't been changed. People can look that stuff up and make a deduction about the church pretty quickly by reading a few very key pieces of literature by those who are esteemed in the church as being, again, prophets, seers, and revelators. It's incredible. And what's interesting about it is that you see a schism or a breakdown between those who are conservative, who feel one way, versus those who are independent, versus those who identify as Democrat. There are differences in the way that they conceptualize this process as well. Mostly large, mostly white folks who have taken – I'm back to the survey again – who have taken the survey. That survey is a powerful tool because it really gives some really interesting information about where white people are today and their ideas about this and stuff. And many whites, believe it or not, feel, again, righteous indignation about it. But many of them aren't willing to do anything. That's the problem. So until white folks join forces with black folks the way it was in the 1950s, 1960s, and I want to underscore this by saying that the majority of white folks that joined the movement weren't whites of Northern European origin, but more Jewish. So even those white folks who identify as their ancestors have come in from Northern Europe, when y'all get pissed off about stuff, stuff happens. Look at the Occupy movement, right? White folks are saying, hey, I'm losing my jobs. Y'all ain't paying us nothing. And what happens? White folks go nuts, and then all of a sudden the system crashes. And when black folks do that, folks get killed. Folks get killed, folks get lynched, folks disappear. When y'all do it, stuff happens. Okay, and so I'm serious. I'm serious about that because 75% of this nation still and declining are folks who identify as white. And so the majority of the money and the power and the resources are white generated because, again, America was founded on principles that pretty much promulgated by whites. So the world as we know it, in this country at least, as we know it, was perpetuated and created and constructed by white folks, people who identify as those who their ancestors come from Europe. So until y'all get pissed off, and I want to say this to the audience again, I want to underscore this, until whites, whether you're in or you're out, get upset about this and push for change, nothing will ever change, if it even will then. Granted that the constellation of individuals that run the church who sit in those red chairs twice a year. So there's got to be a much more concerted, forceful way of asserting the wrongheadedness of this stuff in ways that are productive that move the church forward. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it. But I stand with anyone who's ready to do it.
Well, I do too. And I agree with everything you're saying. And hopefully we can see change coming, and hopefully we can all find opportunity. Because, I mean, both inside and outside the church, there's still work to be done. I mean, the battle's not over yet.
Have we talked about gays and lesbians yet? Have we been there yet? Because, I mean, that's another area we got to talk about. I'm sure you guys have already talked about that.
Gays and lesbians and women still.
And oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mentioned that earlier, that those were the two issues, the paternalism, the treatment of women, the perceptions of women's roles. Yeah. That of, and of course, folks who are considered themselves to be African American or of African descent, and Native Americans. Those are really the sort of the three-headed monster, if you will, that the church needs to deal with, and deal with fairly soon, because the church is losing members. You all know that, right?
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
The church is losing members.
That's not a secret. People aren't joining the church. And those who are young folks are leaving the church. But there's reasons for that. The church is out of step with.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very parishioners it claims it serves.
This is a small anecdote, but a few weeks ago I gave a small presentation to my kids' classes about a recent trip I took to Cuba. Just doing a little bit of the history, I said something about Christopher Columbus and the Taino Indians, and I said, "Do you know what he did with the Taino Indians?" And I had no idea if they would have any inclination at all. And immediately, a dozen hands went up and said, "Yeah, he made them into slaves." Well, that's a piece of historical knowledge that, you know, second and fifth graders have now that I sure as hell didn't have as a kid, and. You know, something that was not acknowledged and talked about in an open way, and to see them acknowledge and say, okay, we understand our past. You know, and just last weekend I was with my kids and we were at a historic plantation here in South Carolina, and I showed them the schoolhouse that slave owner had put up. His last name was Drayton, and this was antebellum. And my son said, "Well, I thought the slaves weren't allowed to be educated." And I said that, you know, generally that's true. And I was surprised at how much he knew. And he said, "Well, then how could he do this?" And I said, "Well, don't you think that was something courageous of him to try and do to educate these people?" And just to give you some context. This reverend, his aunt and mother were the Grimke sisters, who were some of the earliest abolitionists from the South, and who were actually expelled from South Carolina for being outspoken abolitionists. And so you see, of course, I'm speaking from anecdote here, but I think in general you look at the larger trends and see that the younger generations just don't accept the kind of, you know, racism, homophobia, sexism of the past. And I think that's ultimately going to just, you know, push on the church as well.
Mm. We all hope so.
Yeah, there's hope. Who knows what the future holds? And stranger things have happened. But I think, you know, we all sort of need to feel a call to the fight. But Darren, it's been a true pleasure to have you on. Your blog is darrensmith.com. Is that right?
That's right, www.darrensmith.com.
And that's Darron.
That's right.
Yeah, so
The survey that you were talking about, where can that be found?
I think I posted it to Mormon Expressions, if I'm not mistaken. Have you seen it on your site that I posted on your
I think you did, and we will repost it.
If you wouldn't mind, and I that would be awesome, because we've gotten a lot of good data on there. And so what's interesting is that the things that you folks were talking about this evening – really are consistent with what I'm seeing in the survey. So they're very consistent, and they're very, and I think it's very representative of what good intentioned, well intentioned folks are thinking about this issue. So I really appreciate the support there.
Excellent. Like I said, we appreciate your point of view. Okay. Well, as always, the discussion continues on our website at MormonExpression.com. Mormon Expressions are a product of Whitefield's Educational Foundation. Let's see. Troy Olson produced this episode. It was hosted by John and Zilpha, and Rich Rasmussen was our editor. Thanks. Thanks again, everybody.
And thanks our studio audience tonight.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo.
All right. Well, thanks, Darren. Thanks, Christian.
You're welcome.
Troy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take
good
care.
Night.
Good night.
All eyes are on us now. All eyes are on us.